Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. If you have a dog or a cat, you know that there's something going on in those little heads. They know you. They really know you. There's a deep connection here. So what about other non-human animals? Elephants, killer whales, and wolves. What are they thinking and feeling? We can look at them and speculate, but are we projecting our feelings onto them? Is there a bias here? What can science tell us about what's in the minds of non-human animals? Do they think? Do they feel? At what level? Is it comparable to our human emotions? We invite you to join in our conversation as we talk about this. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. And we're joined by Carl Safina. He's the author of the book Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Carl, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So when I say non-human animals, I'm trying to make a point here that we're all animals.
Yes, we're certainly not plants. Yeah. We're all animals.
So we have something in common with these creatures that we marvel at.
We have really almost everything in common with them. We have very similar brains with the same structures that we've inherited from the same places. They make the same chemicals that create our moods and our sense of motivation. We have the same skeleton, the same internal organs. We really differ mainly by outer contours and a few internal tweaks.
But we've seemed to have put a lot of energy into drawing some sort of line between non-human animals and animals, that there is a we're civilized and we make things and or walk upright or things. We try to draw a distinction. And even in your title, you say Beyond Words. Is that where you are drawing the line because of words? We have words.
Well, we have words. We have a lot of words, but some other animals also have words, and some other animals also understand syntax. Some dolphins do, some chimpanzees do, some monkeys use very simple syntax. So I think my point is not that we're not different or that we're all exactly the same, because clearly we all have differences. Humans are special. Elephants are special. Dolphins are special. We're all special in our own individual ways, but there aren't sharp lines. What there are distinctions and differences and being the same in different ways, in a sense. So we have our language, our way of communicating with words. They have their ways of communicating, and they lead really very rich lives, and their mental experiences are in many ways very similar to ours. So I'm not saying that we are all identical. I'm saying that it's all on a continuum, and that those other creatures, they lead lives. They often know who they are relative to their friends, their rivals. They know where they are in their home territories. And their experience of life is not so different from humans, especially if you think of most of the humans that have ever lived, living in small tribal groups and small family groups with defined territories and not really knowing what the really larger world is like, or that the world is round, or that we live on a planet in space. I mean, most humans have never understood any of that, and the experience of most of these other animals is quite similar in many ways to human tribal peoples, I would say in that way. Although our technology was a little more sophisticated, most tribal peoples had bows and arrows, and chimpanzees don't have anything like a bow and an arrow. But they do use rocks and an anvil to crack nuts or pound open nuts with wooden implements and some things like that. So you see that it's all on one smooth continuum, and our thoughts and our emotions are also on one smooth continuum.
Well, so it seems like you're saying that there is some form of mindfulness of many animal species, particularly the ones that you have focused on, elephants, killer whales, and wolves, chimpanzees. What is that mindfulness that they have? How different or similar is it to our own? And can humanity be accused of being willfully ignorant about this situation? And that's why you wrote the book.
Yeah. They go to places they have in mind. They look for individuals that they know. They have enemies and rivals. They understand their relationships with them. They seek greater status, form alliances, depose others to try to get their own status. Their lives follow the arc of a career. And in many cases, their lives are, you know, very understandable because we see all these elements in our own lives as well. But we have remained really quite willfully ignorant and really refusing to acknowledge the obvious in many cases because it makes things easier for us to do so. And people say, well, you shouldn't assume that other animals have thoughts and feelings like humans do. And that's true. You shouldn't assume that. But you also shouldn't insist that they have no thoughts or feelings when it seems clear that they are trying to keep themselves alive. They're caring for their offspring. They know where they're going. They know where they intend to be as they travel and those kinds of things.
But elephants, you look at elephants very closely in the book, and you talk about how elephants are a who. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's just one sort of distinction that I'm trying to show, that we refer to all animals as it, usually. And many animals are defined by their social relationships to other animals. Any elephant is part of a family and an extended social group where they know exactly who they are. They know who their mother is, their aunts. They know who their friends in other families are. They know if other elephants are unknown to them. If they're strangers, they know that they're strangers. They can recognize each other's voices. Most elephants probably know hundreds of other individual elephants in a population, and they travel as a family unit with an elder female as the lead and all her adult daughters and their young ones. And the males travel in male groups or wander around more, but the female family unit, the female-led family unit, is the unit of elephant society, and they all know exactly who they are. So to them, they are who's. They know who they are, and we should recognize that, and we should refer to them that way as a way of acknowledging the reality of how they experience life.
As compared to, what, an anchovy or a crab? They don't think that way?
Well, yeah, I mean, fish are a good example because there are some fish, like if you think of an anchovy in a school of a million anchovies, they don't have long-term individual relationships or pair bonds. They don't have parental care. They don't defend a territory. Some other kinds of fish do all of those things, but some don't. Or if you think of, to really depersonalize it completely, think of a mosquito. A mosquito doesn't really mean much to other mosquitoes as an individual. So you could, you know, swat the mosquito and call it an it. But and this gets down to sort of where the rubber meets the road. If you kill the leader of an elephant family, the survivors will suffer more than the one who died, and their survival rates go down. They don't know what to do because the elder is the one who had the knowledge of where to go when there was a terrific drought.
Carl, I got to interrupt you. We're going to continue talking about this. I have to take this one-minute break. Our phone line is 210-614-8980, The Secret Minds of Animals on The Source. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Carl Safina, and he's the author of several books. He's written extensively about how the oceans are changing, and not for the better, the lives of free-living animals and the human relationships with the natural world. He's also a host of the PBS series Saving the Ocean with Carl Safina. So earlier we were talking about elephants and how they have a very strong family unit, and when a poacher comes along, and this happens far too often, and they kill an elderly elder elephant. They're not just killing that animal, but they're also taking away information that's useful to that unit.
Well, they're changing the trajectory of the lives of all those individuals, and they're causing intense pain because the social bonds are so strong that, first of all, the chaos of the attack is something that can traumatize them long term. And secondly, they grieve and really feel the loss. And thirdly, the leadership information of that elder is gone, and that results in more death among the survivors, less birth among the survivors because they're not in as good condition, often for several years after that. And these are things that we tend not to think about, and they make life less convenient for us because if animals are really experiencing life out there, and if they are suffering and grieving or joyful with their children, you know, what is the implication? It's kind of like what we have faced with other groups of human beings that we denied were like us and denied that they could appreciate love and all these kinds of things. And that was an excuse to do whatever we wanted to them.
How close are we to extinction for elephants?
We're certainly driving elephants extinct. Their range, let's say in Roman times, 2,000 years ago, before Europeans had much to do with Africa, elephants went from the shores of the Mediterranean down to the Cape of Good Hope, except for the bleakest parts of the Sahara. There were elephants everywhere in Africa. Now they occupy 10% of the range that they occupied then. They occupy only about half of the range they occupied in 1970, and their numbers are down probably 99% since Roman times. They're down by about half since the middle of the 20th century, and an elephant gets killed by a poacher every 15 minutes. It's the geography and the trajectory of a magnificent creature that is being absolutely annihilated and driven completely to extinction. And at this rate, they will go extinct. The hope is we can change that, but a lot of energy needs to be applied in order to fix that problem. And even then, if you look at a map of where elephants still exist, they can't all reach one another. They're in little fragmented places and tiny, very insecure refuges that are mostly not really big enough to maintain them really long term. So it's a terrible situation for them.
Let's go to the phone lines now. The number is 210-614-8980 if you want to talk about what's happening with the minds, what animals, what they think, what they feel. We're talking with Carl Safina. He's the author of the book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Gerald has called in. Gerald, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Gerald. I'm from San Antonio. I was wanting to ask how the thought process of animals, like in the wild, like say you were talking about elephants, wouldn't it, how they perceive things through their vision, like through their sight, wouldn't that change their perception of thought, how humans do, how we see things, and how animals, their sight, some see in the dark and night vision or whatever, how they would change their thought process and how we perceive it and how they perceive it would be different?
All right, Gerald, thanks for that great question. Appreciate that.
I don't know if it changes their thought process. I mean, we all have eyes, ears, noses, and feel, you know, sense of touch, and, smell, well, noses, as I said. So we have different ways of emphasizing the information coming in, because an elephant, for instance, sense of smell is incredible compared to ours. The same thing with a wolf's sense of smell. A whale has essentially no sense of smell, so they rely on visual and hearing information. But once they know things like, my friend is over there, my baby is over here, there's food in this direction, I want to go to this other place where we were eating yesterday, who is that? That seems to be an enemy. I better get out of here. I think that those thoughts are very basic and very similar among us, a sense of fear, the sense of wanting to be close to the individuals that you know. And a lot of things for us, we don't verbalize a big long story to ourselves when we have feelings like this. For instance, if you're, let's just say you're out walking on a dark street and there's nobody else around, you're not really sure that you should really be there, and you see a stranger on the opposite side of the street. They look a little sketchy. They're paying a little too much attention to you. You just feel afraid. You know, you don't have to go through a long process of telling yourself a story. You just have a reaction like, oh, who is that? I'm not sure that this is good. And you don't have to say those words. You just feel those things. And the logic of other animals' behaviors suggests that their feelings are very, very similar, because they behave in ways that totally make sense to us when we see that. You know, they show apprehensiveness if things are a little uncertain. If something is certainly dangerous, they show fear. If they see somebody that they know and they want to be near, they look like they're happy to go over there. So I think that their mental experience of that is really rather similar to ours. And I think that if you put together all the information we have, what their brains are like, the logic of their behaviors in those situations that make sense, then I think that that's really the only conclusion that is sensible.
So, Carl, which animal do you think is the one that is so freaky smart?
Well, the killer whales are really the most completely astonishing of all of them, because, as I've been saying, many, many animals' behavior makes total sense to us, but killer whales and occasionally certain dolphins do things that people cannot understand how they're doing it. It seems like they can read your minds, or they have some other mode of understanding what's going on. And there are some very strange stories out there about things that dolphins have occasionally done, or killer whales do, that defy any explanation.
Like what? What's a strange story from a killer whale?
One example, I'll give you an example from some dolphins in the Bahamas that were being studied by Denise Herzing, and she wrote about this in her book. She's been studying them for about 30 years. When they go to work on them, they go with a boat and they anchor up the boat for 2 weeks, and the dolphins recognize them, and they know all the dolphins individually, and everybody knows everybody. And the dolphins are usually kind of happy to see them. They come around, jump around, bow ride as the boat is coming in. And one day they went there, and the dolphins would not come anywhere near the boat, and they were acting very, very skittish. And somebody suddenly came on deck as they're trying to figure out what is going on with the dolphins. Somebody came on deck and reported rather grimly that a person who had gone to take a nap had died in their bunk. Now, how in the world could dolphins know that on this boat with people, one person inside the boat had a heart that stopped beating? Why would they be spooked by this? You know, what concept of death would they have that would make them afraid of this? And then, of course, the people in the boat immediately pulled the anchor and went back to shore. And then the dolphins, instead of bow riding as they were going back to shore, they were sort of flanking them at a distance, and then they fell behind. And when they came back a few days later, after they attended to the grim business of the person who had passed away, they came back out again, and the dolphins were all frolicking around, riding the bow wave as usual, and acting perfectly normal. Now, that all really totally defies explanation. With killer whales, there have been a couple of documented stories, two researchers, one in the United States, one in Canada, completely lost in the fog and not knowing where to go. And this was many years ago, before GPS or anything like that, not knowing where to go. And suddenly, killer whales that they had been studying and that they knew individually appeared next to their boat and start acting like they want to go in a certain direction, and as if to lead them. And they said, okay, we'll follow the killer whales. And they followed the killer whales for, in one case, about 15 miles, and suddenly broke out of the fog. And there is the person's home on the shoreline, directly in front of the boat, right where the killer whales were leading them, and then the whales turned around and left in the opposite direction. So those stories really defy explanation and are very, very strange and very humbling as far as wondering if they have a totally different way of thinking and communicating than we understand that they do.
So I got about 90 seconds left in this show, and I want to talk very quickly about acidification of the oceans. I mean, where do we need to know about this really quick?
Oh, acidification of the oceans. Well, it's happening because of the carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels, the same carbon dioxide that's warming the world, is causing the ocean waters to become more acidic, and the chemical reaction uses up carbonate ions, which is needed by anything that makes a calcium carbonate shell. So clams and oysters or reef-building corals that build their hard parts out of calcium carbonate are already growing slower. They're not as thick. They're not as strong.
So this is real. It's happening. It's happening now.
Yes, it's happening now. And as it accelerates, it may really mean that the ocean can no longer have shellfish and coral reefs. It's a mind-boggling thing to contemplate.
Needs to be part of our conversation. We need to talk about this more. But thank you so much, Carl Safina, for joining us. His book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And this is The Source on KSTX, and I appreciate you tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Paul Flav and David Martin Davies. Our engineer is Doug DeMore. Management and oversight provided by News Director Shelley Koffler and VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.